The conclusion of 21 brought about the end of the kingdom of Judah and the time period known as Judah alone. We discovered that after three successive invasions in 605, 597, and 588, Nebuchadnezzar succeeded in breaching the wall at Jerusalem and destroying the Temple of Solomon. This concluded the long period of the history of Israel and Judah in the land of Israel as a nation together and as an individual nation. In addition, it brought to pass the earlier prophecies which began in the wilderness and were given by Moses as recorded in the book of the law. On previous cassettes, we were able to examine some of these scriptures which began with Moses and continued on down through the book of Kings, and we read that these same kinds of predictions were presented to the monarchs by the prophets. When the prophet came before the king, he would put out his hand and say, "Thus saith the Lord." And because of the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel 7, God never allowed the kings to forget that they were sinning, but constantly had his prophet on the scene to accuse the king, to rebuke him, and attempt to bring the king back to the true worship of Jehovah. However, we read in the Word that God rebuked them, but they would not listen. I suppose the irony of the situation is that Abram was called from the geographical area which came to be known as Babylon. So what we have is, in actuality, a 1,500-year cycle back into the land from whence their founder came. When God called Abram from Ur of the Chaldees, he called Abram and selected him to be the progenitor or father of a great nation that could not be numbered, a people as numerous as the sand of the sea and the stars of heaven. He was also given the promise that it would be through Isaac that the seed would come. And this seed, referred to by Paul later on in the New Testament, is known to be a singular seed and found its ultimate realization in the Lord Jesus Christ. However, the progeny of Abram ended up back in the land from which he came almost 1,500 years after God called him from that land. What we have then is a 1,500-year cycle of futility. A 1,500-year cycle of God attempting by using every way possible other than ultimate force to cause these people to love him for what he is, to obey his ordinances and his commandments, and live in the land and prosper. Throughout the Old Testament, we consistently read that God says over and over again, "What more could I have done? What more could I have done to have made the circumstances such that you would have obeyed me and that you would have prospered in the land?" God says, "I did everything divinely possible," other than using ultimate force, which God would never do, because throughout this time period, man was allowed to live by using his own free will in a way that would allow him to choose evil or choose God. When the inhabitants of Jerusalem arrived in Babylon in 586, they would have been met by Ezekiel, who had been there since 597, and Daniel, who had been there since 605, along with the others that were removed from the land during the two previous invasions. As one examines the conditions of the children of Judah in the land of Babylon, it was not as bad as it probably was in the land of Egypt. I believe that the book of Ezekiel indicates that they had a certain amount of freedom. They were used as forced laborers and workers, of course, we know that. But they were not kept in chains and tortured as we ordinarily think slaves would be. The primary hardship was that they were unable to worship Jehovah, because they were exiles from the land where Jerusalem and the Temple of Solomon had been. Therefore, they could not participate in these festivals and worship systems which had been described by God for the covering of sin. The Jew has always been tied to the land. All of the promises given to the Jews, beginning with Abraham, are tied to the land. It is the desire of the godly Jew to return to the land. But while in Babylon, the Jew is not in his land, and everything that he loves and holds dear is separated from him. And it will be the cry of the Jew to return to the land so that the godly ones can begin to rebuild the temple and to reestablish the worship system necessary to please Jehovah. While the Jews are in Babylonian captivity in the 6th century B.C., many things are beginning to happen in the civilized world. Aesop's fables are being written. The theater at Delphi is being built. At this point in time, the oracle at Delphi and the priestess at Delphi are at the height of their influence. Pythagoras, the philosopher and mathematician, is developing the Pythagorean theorem in the latter part of the 6th century B.C. Confucianism is beginning in China. Buddhism is beginning. Buddha leaves his home to devote himself to philosophy and asceticism. He preaches his first sermon in Deer Park of the Holy City in 521 B.C. The Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, is being built. And, of course, we come in contact with that temple during the journeys of the Apostle Paul. The Temple of Apollo at Corinth is being built. The Temple of Olympian Zeus at Athens is being built. Nebuchadnezzar at this time in Babylon is building the palace with the terraced gardens, presumed to be the legendary Hanging Gardens, one of the seven wonders of the world. Also, Nebuchadnezzar has built a tunnel more than a half mile long, connecting the palace and the Temple of the Sun. It traverses the Euphrates below the riverbed. The Greek philosophers in this time period are adopting a theory that the earth is a disk covered by a dome of sky, or as floating free in a spherical sky. And Darius I, a little later, uses pontoon bridge warfare as he crosses the Bosphorus. We have the first reports of papyrus being used in Greece during this century, and the Persians a little later will be wearing tightly fitting leather clothes. In Babylon, the exiles will experience banking because the banking business is being practiced in Babylon during this time. And Darius is going to found the city of Persepolis and will explore the Indian seacoast. While all of these things are occurring in the civilized world, the Jews are captives in the city of Babylon, and in the land of Babylon. Ezekiel and Daniel are prophesying and encouraging the people. God is waiting until the predicted time of captivity comes to an end, so that he can once again begin to work through his people and speak to them through his prophets. It is necessary to examine what happened following the invasion of Nebuchadnezzar in 586. Fortunately, we have an eyewitness account. The eyewitness account is written by Jeremiah. To read the eyewitness account of Jeremiah, it will be necessary to turn to the book of Lamentations. Because of the nature of Jeremiah's message, he is allowed to make a decision whether or not he wishes to return to Babylon or to stay behind. Jeremiah chooses the latter and stays behind following the invasion of Nebuchadnezzar and the destruction of Jerusalem. What Jeremiah witnessed was summed up in one verse 55 years earlier by the prophet Zephaniah in chapter 1, verse 18. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath, but the whole land shall be devoured by the fire of his jealousy, for he shall make even a speedy riddance of all them that dwell in the land. This has taken place. Nebuchadnezzar and his generals have left. They have gone back through the broken wall and carried the people captive back to Babylon. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, walks around the city, sits down and scans the desolation before his eyes, and records what he saw and records what he felt in the book of Lamentations. Beginning in chapter 1, how doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? How has she become as a widow, all alone? She that was great among the nations and princess among the provinces, how has she become a tributary? She weepeth sore in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers she has found none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They are become her enemies. In this way, Jeremiah personifies the city of Jerusalem as if she has been a woman. He says that she was a princess. He says now she's a widow. The city is weeping. Her tears are on her cheeks. All her lovers have become her enemies. They have dealt treacherously with her. Interestingly enough, in the book of Hosea, chapter 2, verse 5, as you will see, Hosea personifies Judah as a woman who has been a harlot and has received harlot's wages. The harlot's wages which have been received are those things that cities and nations are interested in. Bread, water, wool, flax, oil. And Jerusalem has sold herself for these things to the surrounding nations and has been involved in a form of worship which we know to be Baalism, which worships Baal and praises Baal for providing these things. Now Jeremiah follows up on this concept and says that all of the nations that she befriended and all of the nations that she involved herself with politically and adopted their gods into her worship system so that she could carry on commerce to receive these kinds of things and so that she could praise Baal for receiving these kinds of things, these nations have moved in against her. They've dealt treacherously with her like a lover deals treacherously with another lover and have abandoned her and become her enemies. Jeremiah continues in verse 4, the ways of Zion do mourn, and he means the roads. All the roads are desolate. The roads of Zion are mourning. Why, Jeremiah, do the roads mourn? Because none come to the solemn feasts. It's almost as if the roads going into Jerusalem would rejoice with the pilgrims that would come up to worship Jehovah. And now the roads are abandoned and vacant and desolate, and even the roads are mourning. All her gates are desolate. What a difference this is. Think back into the book of 2 Samuel 15:2. Even there, when Absalom was meeting the people at the gate to turn their hearts away, at least there was activity. The judges were there. The people were coming in to present their cases before the king. But we find now that the gates are desolate. There's nobody around. I believe this is because there was not justice in the gates. What Jeremiah is showing us here is the judgment of God has fallen on the practices that the people in Jerusalem had perverted. God has a prescribed program for everything. On the other hand, Satan has his antitype, his counterfeit. When we decide to follow Satan's counterfeit or antitype plan rather than God's plan, God will judge the entire principle or the entire prescribed practice. Look at the book of Amos, chapter 5, verse 10. Although Amos is giving his message to the northern kingdom prior to the invasion of the Assyrians, the principle still applied because the same thing was happening in the south in Jerusalem. Amos says, they hate the man who reproves in the gate. So there are those individuals in the gate who attempt to stand for good and for right and for the worship of Jehovah, but the major portion of the population hates him. They abhor or hate the man who speaks with integrity. He goes on to say in verse 12, you accept bribes, you distress the righteous, and most of all, you turn aside the poor in the gate. Much as Absalom took the people that came to plead their case and turned them aside to his own way of thinking and poisoned their minds against David and his leaders, so now we have those people that are in the gates who are turning aside the poor because they could not afford to pay the bribe. So the whole system of justice that God had described is being perverted. What a difference, isn't it, from what we discovered earlier in the time of Boaz, when he could sit in the gate in that small town and enjoy the fellowship of the other elders, when he could discuss the matter of redeeming the land with the nearer kinsmen, when everything was done as God had prescribed it to be done. Times have changed dramatically, because rather than justice being found in the gates, evil and perversion was discovered to be in the gates, and God now has to judge that. Jeremiah goes on to say that the priests sigh. Well, no wonder, because they were evil in the gates as well. Her virgins are afflicted, and she is in bitterness. Well, no wonder her virgins are afflicted, because when the Babylonian soldiers would ravage the city, they would ravage the women as well. Verse 5 summarizes the reasons behind all of these things. Her adversaries are the chief. They are in charge, in other words. Her enemies prosper. Why, Jeremiah, has this happened? For the Lord hath afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions. Her children are gone away into captivity before the enemy. Verse 9 said, she remembereth not her last end. In other words, she did not consider her future. Moses was just the opposite, wasn't he? He did not want to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, that short period of time. Jerusalem's outlook was just the opposite. The inhabitants of Judah wanted that pleasure of sin for a season, and now they are paying an enduring price. Oh, the short-sightedness of involvement in sin. Verse 10 says that other nations have entered her sanctuary, and the ones that God said could not even join the congregation have defiled the sanctuary. And as Jeremiah looks around in verse 12, he says, doesn't anybody want to comfort us? Here we are, we're destroyed, we're in agony, we're in misery, we're suffering, but no one seems to care. Verse 17, Jeremiah says that the Lord has commanded concerning Jacob that the ones round about him should be his adversaries. Well, this is simply a fulfillment of the earlier Davidic covenant where God promised chastisement. In chapter 2, verse 7, Jeremiah very explicitly tells that God abandoned all those material things which he had caused Solomon to make through the plans given to David for the formal worship system so that people could enjoy fellowship with him. We read earlier, however, that his house, the Temple of Solomon, had been polluted by these different Baal worship items, and because of that, and because the people had mistreated the things that he had designed and had no care about the things that he designed, God now, as Jeremiah says in verse 7, just abandons everything and delivers all these things up into the hand of the enemy. It is reminiscent, is it not, of the earlier battle in 1075 BC when God allowed his ark to be taken by the Philistines. This is the same principle here. It is not that God could not have stopped them from destroying the Temple of Solomon. His glory had departed. It was simply an empty building that had been misused and used to worship all these other false gods, which the inhabitants of Judah had imported from the surrounding nations. In verse 14, Jeremiah summarizes the interaction that he had had earlier during his prophetic ministry in the land of Judah. He reminds them that their prophets had seen false and foolish visions, these vain and foolish things. He said, they did not discover thine iniquity. They didn't preach the kinds of things to you that would have brought repentance. Jeremiah, we will discover when we study his book, preached a certain message for the people to follow. He was opposed by the yes men, the professional prophets, who did not agree with his message. The message of Jeremiah would have prevented what he is an eyewitness to here in the book of Lamentations. However, the people followed the preaching and the message and the ministry of the yes men, the godless prophets, and the result was this disaster of which Jeremiah is speaking. I wonder if we can compare this to the kinds of preaching we see around the world today. I believe that pulpits across America and around the world are filled with yes men, with professional prophets, professional preachers. The messages they preach are designed to tickle the ears of the listeners. This was not the kind of message that Jeremiah preached. And I believe that those that respond to that kind of message today will meet a similar end, if not in this life, in the life to come. And by that I mean total destruction, eternal judgment, eternal separation from God in a lake of fire if they do not respond to the kinds of messages being preached by God's men in the pulpits around the world. In verse 20, Jeremiah's heart must be broken as he mentions again the cannibalism which took place inside the city. This carnage and cannibalism was prophesied earlier, and it has now come to pass. In chapter 3, continuing with verse 12, Jeremiah begins to plead himself and almost in a way personifies himself as the city of Jerusalem. He says that God bent his bow and set me as a target for the arrow. My mind goes back to Ahab, because when God had determined to destroy Ahab, he could not escape. And Jeremiah says that the arrow entered my inward parts, and just as the arrow shot at Ahab pierced the joint of his armor, and the arrow shot by Jehu pierced the body of Jehoram. This is how Jeremiah feels. The assassin's arrow has struck him, and he's doomed. He goes on to say in verse 16, he has broken my teeth. And it's unusual here because Jeremiah makes himself the recipient of an imprecatory psalm. Psalm 3:7 contains this imprecation against the enemies of God. He continues in verse 40 by saying, let us examine and probe our ways. Let us return to the Lord. This, of course, is another summary of the basic message of Isaiah, which he gave to the people over and over and over again, repeatedly, as he prophesied prior to the Babylonian invasion. Verse 44 says, you've covered yourself, you've hidden yourself so that no prayer can pass through. Much earlier, in his address to the northern kingdom, Hosea had said in chapter 5, verse 15, the words of God, when God said, I will go away to my place and will not return again. So that's what's happened here. God has gone away. He has departed from the temple. He has withdrawn his hand of protection from Jerusalem, the beautiful city. And the Babylonians have swept in and brought with them utter destruction. Chapter 4 contains specific details regarding the invasion of the Babylonians. Jeremiah says in verse 5 that those individuals who ate dainties and delicacies and were dressed in purple are now sitting in the ash pits. We can think of the earlier message of Amos in chapter 4 to the cows or kine of Bashan, these heavy women who gave instructions to their husband to go out and work hard and cheat some more and bring more money and more fancy food to them. And I'm certain that there were those kinds of people in Jerusalem, but the days of fancy foods and delicacies and dainties are over. They are now eating each other because of God's judgment. Verse 10, the hands of compassionate women boiled their own children. They became food for them. Jeremiah says in verse 12, who could have believed that the city of Jerusalem could fall? Who could believe that adversaries could enter the gates of Jerusalem? Remember the remark made about the Titanic prior to its sailing? God himself could not sink this ship. Well, that was the wrong thing to say, and it's the wrong thing here to say that no enemy could take this city, because we have seen the result when God withdrew his hand. The sins of her professional prophets, the iniquity of her evil priests, these people who have shed blood of the righteous in her midst, Jeremiah says in verse 13, these people are now wandering blind in the streets, and now the ones that were so pious and holy and pure that they would not even speak to those beneath their station are now crying, depart, unclean, depart, don't touch us, because they had been defiled by death and corpses and cannibalism on every hand. In verse 18, Jeremiah says, we couldn't escape. They hunted our steps. We couldn't walk in the streets. Our days were full. They came to an end. Chapter 5 continues. He says, our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our houses to aliens. This is a fulfillment of the earlier prophecy in Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 13. In verse 4, he says, we have to pay for our drinking water. The wood that we use now has to be sold to us. We have to buy it. Verse 12, princes were hung by their hands. The Babylonians came in and took the princes and strung them up by their thumbs and by their hands in the middle of the city. They took the young men and put them to work in the grinding mills, and the young people had to carry the loads of wood back and forth. So Jeremiah has summarized for us the horror and cruelty which the inhabitants of the beautiful city of Jerusalem have suffered at the hands of the Babylonians. His heart is broken because he knows that had the people heeded his earlier warnings and messages from God, this would not have happened. But in the providence and plan of God, because of the earlier predictions based on their failure to obey his ordinances, God has brought this to pass. This is the end of side one.